headlines, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres calls on the U.S. to lift or waive all sanctions on Iran as agreed under the 2015 nuclear deal. The Yemeni army says it has made gains in the fight against former regime loyalists and militia groups in the flashpoint city of Ma'arib. And a UN report says economic impact from the plunge in tourism since the coronavirus pandemic emerged last year could top $4 trillion. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called on U.S. President Joe Biden to lift or waive all sanctions on Iran as agreed under the 2015 nuclear deal. In a report to the UN Security Council, Guterres urged the United States to extend the waivers with regard to oil trade with Tehran. He also called for fully renewing waivers for nuclear non-proliferation projects. UN chief's appeal comes as Iran and the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal are engaged in talks to revive the agreement. The accord got into trouble in 2018 when the U.S. withdrew from it and reinstated sanctions on Iran. Tehran responded by rolling back its commitments. Iran says the U.S. must now remove all sanctions. Iran's president has slammed the U.S. administration for continuing what he calls its economic terrorism against the Iranian nation. Hassan Rouhani says U.S. President Joe Biden is still waging, quote, an economic war that his predecessor Donald Trump started against Iran. Rouhani says Biden is committing the same crimes that Trump did by blocking Iran's access to drug and foodstuff through sanctions. The Iranian president has blasted Biden for going back on his election campaign promise to rejoin the 2015 nuclear deal and lift sanctions on Iran. Political commentator Tohid Asadi says even the United Nations that the U.S. has so much influence on is critical of Washington's hostile policies.
Well, the fact that United Nations is a heavily influenced body by the United States is something I think there is no doubt about. But the recent report and the recent statements that we heard from Mr. Guterres is an indicative of the very fact that even this heavily influenced body cannot put up with the U.S. administration policies. Of course, when he was not the president and he was campaigning for the presidency, he started with some, let's say, statements just putting emphasis on its willingness towards having better relations and having more commitment and trying to fix the problems that exist in U.S.-Iran relations. But the thing is that when it comes to practice, after he could actually become the president, the thing was that he continued and he stick to the same trajectory of a failed foreign policy that Trump started. And of course, Obama was kind of following the same trajectory. The same continuation of a hostile approach has been on the floor pertaining to Iran, either with Biden administration or Trump or anyone else, at least for the past for decades.
Iranian naval forces have launched military drills in the Caspian Sea. Military officials say the drills aim to promote maritime security and send a message of peace across the Caspian Sea region. Different types of surface and flight units are taking part in the military exercises. Missile launchers, fixed-wing planes, helicopters, and electronic warfare systems are being used. Iran is holding its naval drills in an area of over 77,000 square kilometers in the waters of the Caspian Sea. Different defensive and offensive scenarios are implemented with the aim of protecting the country's territorial waters and preserving its transit routes. Iran's national television, the IRIB, has hosted the 10th General Assembly of the Islamic Radios and Televisions Union. This year, the annual gathering focused on the United States' recent measure to seize the websites of 36 resistance media outlets, including that of Press TV. Our correspondent Yusuf Jalali reports from Tehran.
This is the 10th session of the Islamic Radios and Televisions Union, hosted by the Iranian broadcaster, the IRIB. The event brought together representatives of 300 television and radio channels from 33 member states who attended the event through video conference. This year, the session was held with the motto of media justice and freedom of speech.
The 10th General Assembly of the Islamic Radios and Televisions Union comes as the websites of several of its affiliated media outlets were seized by the U.S. government, something which the union views as an attempt to silence dissenting voices.
Last week, the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation confiscated the websites of Press TV and three dozen other Iranian and regional media outlets for what it described as a means to combat disinformation. Addressing the ceremony in Tehran, head of the IRIB, Abdul Adi Ali Askari, condemned the U.S. move as an open violation of freedom of expression, calling it a failed attempt to muzzle the truth.
The extent of the effectiveness of resistance media outlets prompted the U.S. government to breach its own norms regarding free speech and take down those media. So this shows that those media have been successful. But the West must know that their move indicates their weakness, and on the other hand, the seized media will not stop working.
The Islamic Radios and Televisions Union is a multinational entity, which is currently comprised of 228 member media outlets from 33 countries, covering a total of 22 different languages. The main goal of the union is to break the Western monopoly on media and to offer an alternative narrative for regional and global developments, as opposed to the narrative presented by mainstream media. The union says the West has engaged itself in a full-scale media war to silence the alternative voices.
The slogan of freedom of expression is just a tool for the West to impose its will on different countries. Those media outlets that speak the truth and enlighten the minds of the world nations face censorship just because they expose truths that come at the expense of Western interests.
Head of the IRIB World Service, Peyman Jebeli, says the West can no longer pull the plug on the resistance media since they have already reached global audience, including Western societies.
This time, we witnessed global solidarity with the people of Palestine in their resistance against Israel. Hundreds of thousands of people in Chicago, London, and elsewhere in the West voiced their support for Palestinians. Does the U.S. think it can prevent the voices of Palestine resistance from reaching America by blocking our media outlets?
The Islamic Radios and Televisions Union says any attempt by the West to take down independent media is doomed to failure, and they will continue to shed light on the truth. However, member media outlets say they will sue the U.S. for its illegal media crackdown and will take measures to restore the seized websites. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Elsewhere, the Yemeni army says it has launched a missile attack against sensitive military targets in the country's Ma'arib city. The army said it used ballistic missiles to hit those targets. It said dozens of Saudi-backed forces, including several military commanders, were killed or wounded. The Yemeni army dismissed allegations that its operations in Ma'arib target civilians and residential areas. Ma'arib has witnessed fighting between the Yemeni army and forces loyal to the Saudi-backed former regime in the past several months. Members of the Ansar La movement are also helping the army in its operations to retake Ma'arib. The city is the last stronghold of the former regime loyalists. Germany's defense ministry says the country has completed its troop withdrawal from Afghanistan after nearly two decades of engagement. Germany had 1,100 soldiers in the Central Asian country before its drawdown, second only to the United States. Nearly 150,000 German had served in Afghanistan since 2001, 59 of which were killed. In April, Berlin announced its plan to pull out all of its troops from Afghanistan by early July. That after U.S. President Joe Biden declared that all American soldiers will leave the war-torn country by September 11. Tens of thousands of civilians have been killed since the U.S. and its allies started their invasion of Afghanistan. Political analyst Abayomi Azikiwe believes the United States and its allies have failed to achieve their objectives in Afghanistan after nearly 20 years of military engagement.
Well, the German defense minister is trying to put a happy face on the withdrawal, saying that they accomplished everything they set out to accomplish. But everyone knows that is not true. There's still instability in Afghanistan. The Taliban is still a major fighting force. And the government that's been installed and supported and financed by the United States doesn't appear to have any real strength militarily or politically. So in the last few weeks, the Taliban has been taking over towns and districts throughout Afghanistan. So it's clearly not a successful operation for the U.S. But we'll see once the so-called U.S. ground troops are withdrawn by September the 11th, or perhaps before September the 11th.
UN report says global economy could lose over $4 trillion due to impacts of COVID-19 on tourism. The report says last year alone, worldwide drops in tourist arrivals resulted in more than $2 trillion in economic loss. It says the same amount is expected this year, depending on the distribution of COVID vaccines. The UN report says things would be harder for developing countries as they face vaccine inequity. It says these countries have already seen a 60 to 80% decline in tourist arrivals last year. Recently, some nations have eased travel curbs following mass vaccination programs, but the UN report says international tourism is not expected to return to pre-pandemic levels until 2023 at the earliest. Australia's extended lockdown measures to more areas to fight flare-ups of the highly contagious Delta variant of COVID. Alice Springs has become the latest area to put restrictions after Brisbane, Sydney, Perth, and Darwin took similar measures. Now around half of Australians are under stay-at-home orders. Millions more are subject to movement restrictions and mandatory mask wearing. The country has been broadly successful in containing virus clusters, but now the authorities say they have to be cautious and take what they call tough decisions due to the Delta variant. The strain was first identified in India. The UK Conservative government has been rocked by another scandal, this time involving its former health secretary, Matt Hancock, who resigned after he breached COVID protocols. His replacement, former Chancellor Sajid Javid, has promised to tackle both the country's lockdown uncertainty and bring the faltering health service under control, but his critics are asking if he's the right man for the job. Amina Taylor has more from London.
Britain has a new man in charge of the country's health service. Former Chancellor Sajid Javid replaces Matt Hancock to helm the most under-pressure department in government. First point of order, attempting to manage the COVID crisis.
I want to see the restrictions lifted and life going back to normal as quickly as possible. And that's at my right here and now, that is my absolute priority.
But this is no ordinary cabinet reshuffle. Previous Health Minister Matt Hancock was forced to step down after embarrassing revelations about his private conduct were made public.
I understand the enormous sacrifices that everybody in this country has made, that you have made, and those of us who make these rules have got to stick by them, and that's why I've got to resign.
Despite presiding over the shambolic handling of Britain's COVID response, it became clear that Hancock had fallen out of favour inside Downing Street.
I think it's really likely he was pushed. The exact provenance of the CCTV footage from within his office is not clear, but it's clear that it would be very hard to access that if you weren't in some way strongly connected to the government. So if Boris didn't want him to go, someone did very much. It's quite clear that his position was no longer tenable.
For those hoping there'd be a change in approach from the new health chief, they may well be disappointed.
There is no ideological difference between Sajid Javid and Matt Hancock. It's a new face, just as Jeremy Hunt. Jeremy Hunt became an absolutely figure of hate while he was presiding over the NHS, precisely because he was implementing these ongoing privatisation policies. We're living with the consequences of the NHS being driven into the ground. We've seen unprecedented, really corruption, giving away, gifting tens and hundreds of billions during this pandemic. Sajid Javid, I have no doubt, will continue in the same line.
Britain's National Health Service was already creaking at the seams even before the pandemic. And for the millions who've been waiting to see a medical professional, well, they won't mind who is in charge of the health service. They just want to be made better, and made better soon. With COVID dominating the health agenda, Sajid Javid will have his work cut out for him. And as the fate of his two predecessors has shown, landing the top job is the easy part. Amina Taylor, London.
Calls for scrapping Canada's National Day are growing after two mass graves containing Indigenous children's remains were uncovered in the country. Elsewhere, scores of people have died in Canada as a scorching heat wave hits the country's west since Friday. At least 230 people have died in British Columbia, more than half of them in the Vancouver area. Many of them were senior citizens. Local officials believe extreme heat has been a contributing factor. On Tuesday, Canada recorded its highest ever temperature for a third day in a row. It reached 49.5 Celsius degrees in Lytton, British Columbia. However, services have issued alerts for several provinces. They warned that the historic heat wave persists through this week. Temperatures in Canada had never passed 45 degrees Celsius in the past. And the death toll from a high-rise collapse in the U.S. state of Florida has risen to 12. Fatalities rose after another body was recovered from the ruins of the 40-year-old tower. Nearly 150 people are still missing. Florida authorities say they're still hopeful that survivors could be found. Almost half of the 12-story building abruptly collapsed early on Thursday morning when many residents were sleeping. It happened in the town of Surfside near Miami. The cause of the incident has not been determined yet. Initial attention is focused on structural deficiencies described in a 2018 engineer's report. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Bye.
What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
I tell you with confidence, the downward movement of the Zionist regime has started and it will not stop. May 7th, 2021. Israel is not a country. Another noteworthy point is that although that the usurping regime was established in 1948, the ground for occupying that sensitive Islamic region had been prepared years before that. Studying those events in Iran, Turkey, and Arab countries stretching from West Asia to North Africa reveals this bitter truth that weakness and discord in the Islamic Ummah paved the way for the disastrous usurpation of Palestine, allowing the world of arrogance to deliver that blow to the Islamic Ummah. It is instructive that at that time, the capitalism and communism camps colluded with the rich Zionists. It was the English who masterminded the plot and who persisted in it, and then Zionist capitalists executed it with their money and weapons. The Soviet Union, too, was one of the first governments that officially recognized the establishment of that illegitimate regime and later on dispatched a large number of Jews to that area. The usurping regime was actually an outcome of that situation in the world of Islam on the one hand, and of a European plot, invasion and transgression on the other. Today, the situation in the world is not like those days. We should keep this reality within sight. Today, the balance of power has swung in favor of the world of Islam. Various political and social incidents in Europe and in the United States have laid bare the weaknesses and the deep structural, managerial, and moral conflicts among Westerners. The electoral events in the US and the notoriously scandalous failures of the hubristic and arrogant managers in that country, the unsuccessful one-year fight against the pandemic in the US and Europe, and the embarrassing incidents that ensued, and also the recent political and social instabilities in the most important European countries, are all signs of the downward movement of the Western camp. On the other hand, the growth of the resistance forces in the most sensitive Islamic regions, the development of their defensive and offensive capabilities, their growth of self-awareness, motivation and hope in Muslim nations, the increasing tendency to follow Islamic and Quranic slogans, growth in science and growth of independence and self-reliance in nations are auspicious signs of a better future.
Inhumane sanctions imposed on Iran by the West and the U.S. have hampered the country's efforts to purchase vaccines. The sanctions not only targeted the Iranian oil and banking sector, but also hit pharmaceutical companies and are in violation of the U.N. Charter. Meanwhile, the United States has recently issued a guide to pave the way for the delivery of masks, respirators, and vaccines to countries subject to severe sanctions, such as Iran. That's 16 months after the beginning of the pandemic, when the Islamic Republic has made its vaccine and over 82,000 Iranians have died from the coronavirus. The Islamic Republic has managed to join the few countries around the world developing vaccines to fight the coronavirus disease by producing its first domestic COVID-19 vaccine, known as Coviran Barakat. Iran will focus on using three locally made COVID-19 vaccines, including Russia's Sputnik V and a vaccine jointly produced with Cuba named Pasteur-Covac vaccine. Iran has also launched a clinical trial of yet another vaccine, dubbed Nura, as part of its drive to develop COVID-19 jabs. Iran is also participating in the COVAX scheme. That's why the United Nations had previously slammed the group of seven wealthy nations
for failing to come up with a plan to vaccinate the world against COVID-19. For months, the United States, Britain, and Canada practiced vaccine hoarding, even as poorer nations elsewhere had yet to even distribute doses to their medical workers on the front lines of the pandemic. The U.S., its European allies, and their sanctions regime have targeted ordinary Iranian citizens who are facing one of the worst global health crises. Meanwhile, Iran has managed to develop local vaccines amid cruel sanctions and is prepared to mass-produce jabs to provide the world.
Firstly, it says that the Islamic Republic of Iran has a moral medical obligation. It's actually not necessarily trying to profiteer from this vaccine, as with the Pfizer and other vaccines, which are charging very high rates even here. They're making money out of it. It's basically big business. The Islamic Republic of Iran, clearly at something like $8 a shot, isn't profiteering. And I think that, in a way, is one thing which is very positive. The other thing it says about Iran is that it has an ability to do things itself. This advancement in medical fields, in technological fields, scientific fields, bodes very well for Iran's future. It's not relying on the West.
The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, received his first dose of the Coviron Barakat vaccine on Friday. Coviron Barakat vaccine was approved for emergency mass application by the country's health ministry earlier this month. Before receiving his first dose of the Coviron Barakat vaccine, the leader had set two prior conditions. First, insisting not to receive the vaccine outside the schedule that had been devised for the rest of the Iranians, and second, required to receive only Iranian vaccines. After receiving the jab, the leader thanked all those who were involved in the development of the homegrown vaccine. He said there is nothing wrong with using a foreign vaccine along with the Iranian one. However, he noted that he did not want to use a non-Iranian vaccine. That marked the leader's trust in Iranian scientists and his support for domestic production.
I think the first thing it says is that Ayatollah Khamenei himself is demonstrating his approval of this vaccine, and he's showing that he's leading by example in order to instill confidence, one would assume, within the populace as a whole. On the other hand, he's also making it very clear that this vaccine is one that he's accepted because it's produced by the Islamic Republic of Iran, independent of all others.
Coviron Barakat was unveiled on December 29, 2020, and it started to be mass-produced on March 29. That placed Iran among the first countries which started developing a vaccine against coronavirus. Iran is also working on producing several other vaccines to inoculate its population against the pandemic. Under the hardest sanctions, Iran managed to produce its homegrown vaccine. Once again, Iranian scientists proved that nothing is impossible for the Iranian nation, as their will is strong enough to overcome any hardships, including sanctions. Years of foreign-sponsored war in Syria has left more than 380,000 people dead. The UN says nearly 12,000 children have been killed or wounded so far. More than half of Syria's pre-war population of 22 million has fled their homes. Syria is in dire need of help, but surely the West has so far offered nothing but destruction and death to Syrians. The U.S. has targeted Syria with economic sanctions that have severely hit the war-torn country's economy by prohibiting foreign companies from trading with Damascus. Meanwhile, the U.S. and European countries had banned export and investment in Syria, as well as transactions involving oil and hydrocarbon products. Also, smuggling of strategic Syrian resources is another tactic used to put pressure on the government of President Bashar Assad, a move that has caused more instability. Furthermore, over the past years, the U.S. has been leading a military coalition conducting airstrikes against purported targets of the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group inside Syria without any authorization from the Damascus government or a UN mandate. However, numerous reports and official accounts have revealed the U.S. and Israel's involvement in the relocation of Daesh's elements across Syria and shipment of supplies to them. One example is the U.S. aid operation into Idlib. The Syrian Foreign Minister, Faisal Maqdad, has said the U.S. push to renew a cross-border aid operation into Syria's Idlib is aimed at supplying terrorist groups and prolonging the war. Meanwhile, Iran has once again underlined the need for a peaceful solution to the Syrian crisis.
We reiterate once more that the Syrian crisis must be settled peacefully and in accordance with principles of international law, particularly respect for sovereignty and territorial integrity of states, non-intervention and non-interference in their internal or external affairs, and peaceful settlement of international disputes.
Majid Takht-Ravanchi said the current situation in Syria is the result of foreign intervention as well as Israeli aggression. He warned that these issues can negatively impact regional stability and global peace and security. Damascus is determined to restore its sovereignty over the country's entire expanse. The Assad government has proved effective as Syrians continue to recapture key areas from remnants of the Daesh Takfir terrorist group and other foreign-backed terrorist factions across the country. Nevertheless, the presence of U.S. and European forces in addition to Turkish troops has slowed down its advances.
And President Assad has been on the forefront of the struggle against U.S. imperialism in the region. For many years, the U.S. has sought to dislocate, dismember, destabilize the Syrian nation. We saw this in 2011 through 2015, 2016, some of the roughest years of the U.S. funding Western-backed terrorists, Wahhabis trained and armed and funded by Israel, Saudi Arabia, the United Kingdom, the United States.
Thousands of Syrians have died since the outbreak of the Western-backed war in 2011 to topple President Bashar Assad. After failing to oust the Syrian government through proxies and direct involvement, the U.S. government stepped up its economic war in Syria by imposing crippling sanctions. Acting Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Affairs, Joy Hood, warned countries in West Asia against restoring ties with Syria. He also warned the prospect of sanctions against countries that normalize relations with Syria and do business with Damascus. Hood noted that the only way to achieve stability in Syria is through a political process. He also stated that Washington is committed to working with allies, partners, and the UN to ensure that a durable political solution remains within reach. That's why Washington and its allies are inside Syria without the invitation of the Damascus government or a UN mandate.
One of the biggest techniques of U.S. imperialism is to create chaos and destabilization in a country that is anti-imperialist, that is against the empire, that defends its people. They create chaos there, and then they blame that chaos and destabilization on the policies of that government.
Syria's Foreign Minister Faisal Maqdad called Washington's policy pure hypocrisy, citing wide-ranging U.S. sanctions against the war-torn Arab country. Maqdad further accused Western countries of killing Syrian people with their sanctions. Like it or not, Washington and its allies have failed to oust Bashar Assad, and his government is supported by the Syrian people. The presence of foreign forces in Syria is illegal and must end, as it is the root of instability in the country.
Tensions in the Black Sea are on the rise after a British Navy warship breached Russian territorial waters off the Crimean coast on Wednesday. Russian Defense Ministry said in a statement that Russia's Black Sea Fleet and the Russian Federal Security Service had stopped the violation of the state border by the British destroyer HMS Defender off Crimea's Cape Fiolet. According to the ministry, the British military vessel ventured 3 kilometers into Russian territorial waters, prompting a Russian border guard patrol ship to fire warning shots and a Sukhoi 24M bomber to drop bombs in front of the destroyer. Following the warning maneuvers, the HMS Defender left the waters, but the British side denied that warning shots had been fired and that any bombs had been dropped in the path of the HMS Defender. Earlier in the day, Russia said hostile actions by the British warship near Russian territorial waters could not have been carried out without the U.S. green light.
I mean, in the sense that the U.S. and the U.K. are sending their fleet far away from home and obviously making provocative actions that are directly related to their interference in the internal affairs of Ukraine. Yes, of course, the United States and the U.K. are guilty of these kinds of unwarranted provocations intended to create pressure on Russia. However, the fact of the matter is that these kinds of incidents are relatively common, and they can be expected. What the only unusual part here is that Russia is not backing down and is not giving in to the British pressure.
Russia has warned that it will defend its borders by all means, including with its military. Russia's foreign ministry has summoned the British ambassador to strongly protest what it called the British ship's violation of its territory. The ministry said it delivered a strongly worded protest to the envoy over the British Navy ship's, quote, provocative and dangerous actions. It said London would be fully responsible for any consequences if a similar incident happened again. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, however, defended the Navy ship's decision to navigate inside the Russian waters.
I think it was wholly appropriate to use international waters. And by the way, the important point is that we don't recognize the Russian annexation of Crimea. This is part of a sovereign Ukrainian territory. It was entirely right that we should vindicate the law and pursue freedom of navigation in the way that we take the shortest route between two points, and that's what we did.
Earlier this month, Russia announced a plan to boost its military presence along its western borders to counter increased NATO activities there. In the meantime, NATO has pressed ahead with its military drills near the Russian ground and maritime borders, a move that Moscow deems provocative.
The frequency with which the NATO, let's refer to the United States and the UK as the key NATO powers, the frequency at which they are doing this and the directness of their approach. There's no pretend here that there was an accident. This is an intentional heightening of military tensions, and it is intentional.
It appears that another Cold War between Russia and the West is likely to be on the horizon. The possible crisis, however, could prove even costlier than the first for both sides.
Generations of horrific abuse of Indigenous people in Canada once again under the spotlight. A First Nations group in Saskatchewan province has revealed that the remains of hundreds of people, mostly children, were discovered at the site of a former Catholic boarding school there. Local Indigenous leaders want an inquiry into what they call genocide. The First Nations group said that the church that ran the residential school removed the headstones. The piece of tragic news came just weeks after the discovery of the remains of over 200 Indigenous children rattled the country. The latest finds have reopened old wounds in Canada about the notorious residential schools, mostly operated by the Roman Catholic Church for the government of Canada. During the 19th and 20th centuries, 130 boarding schools forcibly separated more than 150,000 Indigenous children from their families. The program was aimed at assimilating Indigenous youth, but the school subjected them to malnutrition and physical and sexual abuse. An estimated 6,000 First Nation kids died while attending these schools. Under mounting pressure, the Canadian government formally apologized for the system in 2008. However, despite growing calls, the Pope and the Roman Catholic Church have refused to apologize.
They're abrogating their responsibilities. By admitting their crimes, they're admitting that they're not following their own teachings. The crimes that they committed are so horrific, and children were beaten for simply speaking their own languages.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said on Thursday that he was terribly saddened by the new discovery. He said the trauma that Indigenous people feel is Canada's responsibility to bear. But has Ottawa really learned a lesson, and is it serious about alleviating the plight of First Nations? Canada is ranked among the world's seven largest advanced economies. The modern country, with one of the highest GDPs in the world, has long been a popular destination for millions of immigrants from across the globe seeking jobs and a better life. While Canada may sound like a dream world to many, it is far from a utopia for its own Indigenous population. Canada's 1.7 million Indigenous citizens, nearly 5% of the population, mostly live in isolated communities where poverty, high unemployment, and high rates of suicide are chronic problems.
There are psychological problems that have been passed down from generation to generation. Fathers who were in the generations in the residential schools and mothers suffered severe psychological problems because of the treatment they received. And that's just been passed down from generation to generation. And it's going to take years to correct that.
They have long complained that they are not getting a fair share of incomes from resources on their ancestral lands. Meanwhile, Aboriginal women have been subjected to deadly violence for many years. A national public inquiry concluded a few years ago that about 1,200 Aboriginal women had been murdered or gone missing in Canada since 1980, with activists putting the number much higher. Human rights groups have repeatedly raised the alarm about the situation of Canada's Indigenous population. Canada says it is ashamed of systemic racism, discrimination, and injustice that Indigenous peoples have faced. In 2017, the Canadian government acknowledged the humiliation, neglect, and abuse of First Nations and pledged to improve their lives. But First Nations are still struggling with a long list of problems and are fighting an uphill battle for their rights.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
reasons as why this...
On June 22nd, the U.S. government took down a range of Iranian news websites, including English-language Press TV and Arabic-language Al Alam, a far-reaching crackdown on the Iranian media. Press TV's users were faced with this message. The domain PressTV.com has been seized by the United States government in accordance with a seizure warrant pursuant. The message was part of a broader campaign against the resistance movement in West Asia, as some non-Iranian websites, like those belonging to Yemen's Al Masira TV channel and Bahrain's Lo'lo television network, were targeted as well.
The move shows that the resistance front enjoys wide-spanning influence, because the U.S. government has breached the values it claims to be upholding. The U.S. action is not the first of its kind. During the past 3 or 4 years, many measures have been taken to hinder Iran's speedy progress in the virtual space, from removing Iranian apps in violation of international laws to imposing sanctions on Iranian firms to prevent them from accessing software distribution platforms.
Shortly after, the U.S. Justice Department confirmed in a statement that, pursuant to court orders, the United States seized 33 websites used by the Iranian Islamic Radio and Television Union, IRTVU, and 3 websites operated by Kata'ib Hezbollah, KH, in violation of U.S. sanctions.
The latest measure by the U.S. is against the same principles of free speech, which the country has always been proud of. That means curtailing free speech. The measure means that the U.S. is using tools to prevent the reflection of different viewpoints to the public. The Iranian government condemns this measure.
The seizure timing was suspicious enough, as it came one day after the Iranian president-elect Ebrahim Raisi ruled out a meeting with U.S. President Joe Biden while calling on Washington to lift sanctions on Tehran and rejoin the Iran nuclear deal. Press TV was launched in 2007 with the motto of "The Voice of the Voiceless." Since the very beginning, the news channel has always tried to shed light on major regional and global issues from perspectives either ignored or distorted by the mainstream media. Over the past years, the channel has repeatedly been subject to censorship on multiple platforms, including Twitter and Instagram, besides Google and its services. For example, it was in mid-January 2020 that tech giant Google permanently removed Press TV UK's YouTube channel. The channel had over 28,000 subscribers on its YouTube account at the time of its deletion.
It just goes to show how wafer-thin all the Western propaganda about media freedom, freedom of speech, and so on really is. The truth is they want their overweening narrative to completely dominate the public discourse so that decisions made about Iran, war and peace, sanctions, not sanctions, the nuclear deal or not, they want those decisions to be made with an uninformed public.
A few years earlier, in 2013, Press TV was forced off the air in the UK after media regulator Ofcom revoked its license for allegedly breaching the Communications Act. Shortly after, the channel was also taken off air in North America.
I don't obviously agree with everything Press TV do, but what they do is they provide a means for dialogue and discussion and understanding of the Middle East, particularly, and not only the Middle East, but many other world issues. Now, this vital conduit of news and information is being closed off by the British government, who are blaming it all on Ofcom. The British government won't take any responsibility for this outrageous, tyrannical act.
In fact, Press TV has had a long history of poor treatment at the hands of the US state. In just one case, back in January 2019, the FBI illegally detained Press TV anchor Marzia Hashemi for 10 days on her visit to the United States.
situation in the United States that individuals can be detained, arrested without charge.
I was treated in many cases worse than a common criminal, as if I was a mass murderer.
I was kidnapped. Kidnapping, transferring, shackling, imprisoning, taking off my hijab, and so many other things. They can call it legal, but we know that it is not legal. Why is it that in the jails here, that 98.5, if not more, of the people I saw were Black Americans?
While it has become an everyday challenge for Press TV and its sister channels to deal with problems caused directly or indirectly by the US government on flimsy pretexts, a number of channels such as BBC Persian and Iran International, which seek subversive agendas inside Iran via spreading misinformation, are all immune to Washington's whims. A minor case of hypocrisy by the self-proclaimed champion of freedom of expression. It's not simply a practice of undermining journalism or free speech. It is an attack on the truth itself.
Any of these countries like China, Russia, Iran, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Cuba, they are demonized and their media outlets are portrayed as foreign agents, which is quite incredible. And we've seen incredible hypocrisy in the sense that not only does the U.S. government falsely dub these fact-oriented, totally fact-based media outlets as supposed foreign agents, but even on social media, which is ostensibly independent from the U.S. government, but really we know that many of these big tech corporations in Silicon Valley are U.S. government contractors that closely follow the U.S. government line. They have also been labeling foreign government-backed media outlets like RT, like CGTN, like Press TV, labeling them as controlled by the Russian government, as Google says, and Google owns YouTube, and we've also seen Twitter do the same thing, and Facebook.
The fact is, the mission of Press TV's independent journalism, which is to set distorted narratives right across the region and the world, has made the channel a strong alternative voice for the oppressed. And that's not what the Americans can put up with.
The Western media and the West-controlled media, you know, or the what they call the mainstream media, they portray a particular thing, a particular, you know, international problem in a particular this frame. And Iranian, the Press TV is challenging that. Probably they are providing an alternative thought. So naturally, this is a competition. So in that competition, Press TV is now facing the heat.
By way of comparison, what they've done to Press TV is a larger scale operation of what they've done to the founder of WikiLeaks and other whistleblowers across the world, muting alternative voices at any cost. In the words of Asa Winstonley, the Electronic Intifada, an online Chicago-based publication covering the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, the action of the U.S. government in seizing these websites shows that this is the action of a gangster regime. It is the action of thugs, really. The U.S. government is no stranger to using the American monopoly over the means of communication online to shut down alternative voices from other countries. For example, in August 2018, Facebook deplatformed Venezuela-based outlets Telesur English, which offered differing opinions and analysis of the U.S. government's actions in Venezuela and Latin America. American scholar Richard Falk believes that by shutting down Press TV, the U.S. is attempting to deprive Iran of its capacity to challenge hostile propaganda and put forth its own counter-narrative of controversial events and more generally of peace, justice, and democratic governance. All in all, this is not the first time Press TV is targeted by the U.S., and by the looks of things, it will not be the last one. Fighting for the truth is what Press TV unflinchingly believes in, and it will never give it up, come hell or high water.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered? proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. In this episode, we are going to talk about some of the Islamic laws of miscellaneous nature according to Ayatollah Sistani. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hawza lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzumah Sabzawari and Sharh Ashraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazwini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in Fiqh and Usul. His Eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Halli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Halli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Sheikh Javid, what are the different types of waiting periods or iddah?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, there are three types of iddah period or waiting period, you know. Iddah period for the for temporary marriage, which is 45 days.